What about that? And you got to learn to go outside. You got to start reading things, meeting people, being curious. Stop worrying about yourself. Just totally eradicate and subordinate and basically suspend in the back of your brain anything about your self-servingness. Start being outwardly focused. Learn about everything and everybody outside your business. That's where you have the greatest exponential growth, not within your business. Because everybody in your business is doing the same thing the same way, aren't they? So that's what a dumb thing to spend time figuring out what they know that you don't. They don't know anything you don't. Probably, particularly after this weekend. Sell it to them. Sell it to them. Failure to determine and address your customer and prospect's needs. How many of you ever call on your customers? How many of you ever go with your customers out on sales calls and act like you're a salesman? How many ride silently and observe? How many go work their factory? Good for you. How many people should do that? Raise your hand. How many people buy from their competitors? How many people walk in their competitors' stores? Spend money. Very few. You should, particularly ones that are better than you and ones that aren't. How many call on people outside your marketing area that are competitors generically but not directly and pick their minds? Does it work? Yeah. Most people are very happy to do it. If they're not happy, you can offer to pay them $100 an hour for their time, and they're so flattered they'll just spill any beans you want to know. But if you don't do that, why? It's the same thing. I won't go back to the diving board. Why let your knowledge base be singular when you can make it so broadened just by a little effort? Forgetting you're never recognized, you have to both sell and educate your way out of a business problem. You can't just cut the price. I've demonstrated that so many times, I'm not even going to elaborate on it. Failing to make doing business your company easy, appealing, desirable, and even fun. That can only happen when you think about it from the context of what Mike Bash said, when you put yourself in your customer's shoes, when you basically get on the other side of the desk. Stop sitting on your side of the desk, philosophically or maybe in actuality. Move your perspective to the other side of the desk. Move your perspective to the other person's eyes. Move your perspective to the other person's situation. And don't be as limited and as short-sighted to think entirely and myopically in terms of just the area of interaction that you deal with. Think more totalistically or holistically about all the elements that impact their business and their lives. It will give you such a decisive, cumulative, ongoing, distinctive advantage you will not believe it. Failing to tell customers the reasons why. Biggest missing sentence in everything you do to motivate customers, to compel customers, to make propositions is the essence of because or why. Unless you give me a reason why I should do things, and the reason can't be because you want it, because I could care about you. It can't be because you need it, because I could care about that. It can't be because you're better, because I could care about that kind of a nebulous, innocuous word like quality, service, and dependability, because I don't know what your definition of that is. All I know is it's meaningless. It's a superlative. It is absolutely, unequivocally unimpactful to me. Specificity. Can't talk. Specificity. Illustration. Measurable, dramatic, graphically illustrated comparisons. Talking about results, performance, illustrated examples of why my life will be enhanced. Why my life will be improved. That's the only way you can compel me. If you can't give me reasons why, don't even try to sell me. And selling me is not just me, the customer. It's your employee. It's your vendor. It is your wife or your husband. Anybody you're trying to impact. Read that book, Influence. It's really quite good, don't you think?
Superb.
It'll give you basis to believe what I'm saying. Not sticking with marketing campaigns that are still working. In the concept of optimization, you want to jettison all elements of conjecture and subjectivity from every aspect of your business. You want to be totally scientific. You don't want to make any decision yourself. You never want to tell your market a thing. You want to ask the market every question. And the first thing is, how often should I keep running my ads or my promotion? And the market will say, well, until we stop responding. That means you don't change it initially. You don't stop running it. You don't run it too infrequently. You keep doing it as often as it works. However, semicolon, however, there's my semicolon, comma. your charges, as long as things are working, you use the protective safe harbor comfort and the velocity of success to allow you to use a modest amount of your capital to start experimentally testing alternative approaches, advertisements, other ways of accessing the market to see whether there's a better control or a control that reaches a different segment of the market. Kevin did an experiment. I don't know if he, and I can't remember what he told me or he told the group. They found that they could do two different things to the same market and get two different segments of the market to respond because there were different hot buttons that hit different, totally different kinds of people. You guys are here. I use my illustration of subjectivity and objectivity. Different points evoke different response because we've got here those 40 or 50 different frustrations and visions. If I talked about one frustration in a headline or an approach, that would appeal to maybe 20 of you. It wouldn't appeal to 40 of you. Another one might appeal to 50 and not 20. Your goal is to find multiple ones so you can build those broadened pylons. Does that make sense? When preparing ads, TV, radio commercials, direct mailings, forgetting to focus on the intended customer and no one else. Also, when you do these things, anything you do in mass is really being heard, being seen, being read one person at a time. I'm uttering my message right now ostensibly to 100 people, right? Or 200 people.
Mechanically in some sense.
Mechanically. But it's being listened to by one person at a time. It's being interpreted very differently by each one of you. As far as you're concerned, what's your name, sir? What is it?
Mark Snyder.
Mark, I'm talking to you. What is your name?
Nancy.
As far as Nancy's concerned, if I do my job correctly, I'm talking to you, aren't I? I'm not talking to Mark. I'm talking to you if I hit the resonating chord, right? If you do it right, if you construct your message on the along the elements that I've taught you and Mac taught you, people won't say, what a great ad. Or people won't say, this is hokey. They'll immerse themselves in it. And the message and the information and the case and the argument, not meaning the anger, but the advocacy and the education will be so powerful, they'll put it down and say, I need that. I want that. One person at a time. Give me some questions.
Okay. Good question here from Randy. Is it Harvey? Haney and Tom Atkin. They want their objective is to move from a service organization to a marketing orientation. Their partners are currently working full time on their projects, and they've had steady growth, but they want to invest more of the partners' time in marketing, product development, without jeopardizing current client relationships and service. How do they do it? They clearly are over invested. They're clearly totally tied up with their project work. So they don't have time to market.
What kind of business is it? I don't know the business. What's the business, sir?
It's a professional.
Right, we're management consultants and projects and business consulting.
I'll give you an answer to that.
Yeah, the Mac answer, I'll give you a little embellishment. Go ahead.
My answer to that is put your fees at a level that you can afford to hire either people who can execute for you on the operations side or you can afford to hire a marketing director.
Right.
And so that
That's
it's
right.
built into your project.
That's right. But
really, you have to delegate.
Mm-hmm.
That's your management.
And by the way,
we understand that the caveat to us is we've been growing at 25% a year because our clients like what we're doing. They like us individually once we've been there. As a result, we get more and more work there, but we need to pull ourselves away from the client.
Maybe not.
Without
you might be better if you're in that kind of business.
Bringing
you
more associates
better,
in.
You may be better be bringing associates in at one level and making some transition back and forth, yeah. And also hiring somebody to do the marketing.
You'll find each person's situation has its own.
If you have exceptional expertise and that's your business, you either have to leverage it through individuals, publications, or mechanical.
Remember Jose's story about he tried to make each one of his restaurants do $5 million and he couldn't do it, but he got each one to do $800,000 or whatever.
It might be better to take one of the people here looking for a place to put their energies, who understands principles,
and put them to work
on the marketing
directly or on a base.
Their marketing
expertise
may be as high as yours. They may be able to get the 95 points on the marketing scale. Well, they're never going to get to 95 points on the
expertise. The question is, you might want to use marketing to cultivate a different aspect of your business And if you do it low risk and experimentally, you might be, if you get to the point where you've got a program that every time you send out 5,000 letters or over a four-month period, every time you address or attack a certain industry or a certain segment of the market, you know you're going to pick up four clients, and four clients will support two associates, then what you do basically is you get the programming down so you can grow predictably at a level where the associate isn't a drain. He's fulfilling a profit center, or she's fulfilling a profit center. I don't know what it is, but you got to. Somebody's got to either relieve you of the management. If you can't, somebody's got to externally or internally full time do the marketing. And the marketing may or may not be most appropriate to build the existing business you've got. You got to step outside and say, is there like the plastic surgeon who said, I can't do more than 150 operations. I could, however, do multiple procedures in each operation and, in essence, double. You got to find out where your highest and best use is based on the constraints that currently compromise your use, your time and access.
Implicit in his approach and yours is that there's no one else in the face of the world who you could possibly strike a relationship with who can do as good a job as you can. And there's no one as good a practice surgeon as him that he could possibly associate.
But the point is, if you could get 20 times more people in your business and you guys couldn't do it, could you find somebody who's 80% as well who probably would do good and you pass it to them? Because if you didn't have them, you wouldn't have the job and split it with them or engage them. You got to ask yourself a lot of what ifs, and until you break through those barriers, that answer is going to be useless.
But honestly, my guess is your fees aren't high enough to cover somebody or else you would have done it.
They are.
They're just taking too big a salaries, Mac.
Oh. Yeah. Isn't that part of the goal?
Well, it depends. But they raise them higher enough so you can give yourself the big salaries and hire someone. Who says that's impossible?
Part of the
because you don't want too much business. If you're in a personal services business, you want to maximize your income, not maximize your hours.
Well, we agree. I think that's at the heart of the challenge.
Well, then you find that then you cut back half your clients and you raise your fees double and and see what's going on, see how it works.
Right, and in point of fact, one strategy with one of our major engagements is moving to a retainer agreement that goes down. So we're addressing it one way with a client.
Well, that may not be to your ultimate advantage, but you just have to play with those factors. There's no other. You have to work on your business, not in your business, unless you are such expertise based that you need somebody else to work on.
And I'll try to spend some cumulative time on the calls we do to try to help.
Jay, what did you mean when you said it is more cost effective sometimes to do business on a national scale rather than on a local scale?
Do you want me to answer that, or do you
sure,
want to?
Sure, you can. You can.
It's easy. I mean, basically, on a local scale, first of all, you don't have any leverage because the advertising is very inefficient. It's very non-segmentable. It's very, very cost ineffective. It's expensive. Nationally, you got a different posture. You can buy publications or lists or tie in with other people who are delivering the market and joint venture with them or get free write-ins or package inserts. You can access people of a very vertical and defined basis so much more cost-effectively nationally, so much more identifiably, so much more segmentably, so much more powerfully. Like let's say you deal with doctors and give me a little city.
Paducah.
Okay, fine. So, I mean, how many doctors are there? On the other hand, if you wanted to reach plastic surgeons and you were selling a product or a service or a software, you could sell nationally so many more because you'd have a list tomorrow of 48,000. There's a plastic surgeon publication. There's probably 35 people selling nationally non-competitive products to plastic surgeons you could tie in a relationship with. Does that make sense to you? It's much more. And your posture is more powerful because you're tying in with other people's postures. Okay?
Jay, how can we get a candid client evaluation of our performance and reputation without purchasing an expensive image survey? And how can I transfer this entrepreneurial spirit to my junior partners and key staff? From Bob Miller.
I'll answer the first part. I mean, yeah. I think if you basically go out to somebody's office or have them come with you or go take them out to dinner and just start talking to them off the record.
With an open mind.
Off the record, and just tell them the truth. Tell them the reason why. Tell them the method of your madness. Tell them the truth. Tell them you want to know the good, the bad, and the ugly.
And don't argue with them.
Tell
just
them why.
Listen.
Yeah, don't say, well, that's not true.
We really tried on that. Just listen.
It's like somewhere in the room, I think she's still here. Linda Blackman, you still here? Or she had to leave? Oh, whatever. She's supposed to be taking notes, and she's going to...
I have her phone card in my pocket. Okay. Somebody handed it to me.
She's going
to...
Well, maybe she's calling it in as lost and stolen. we'll see the gendarmes come and take him away, ha-ha. But I want her to critique me, mannerisms, whatever. Mac critiques me upstairs when I make faux pas blunders. I want to know, and you got to be very objective so you don't get defensive and say, but. You got to say, you're probably right. You got to look, you got to examine.
You know what Jay said when I said that? He said, I know I did that.
But it's like, you know, did you ever do something where you couldn't stop and you sort of had to let it finish, and you meant to correct it, but something happened and just segued your mind, and you just totally forgot?
Burn some circuits there. Yeah.
But the point is, I said this earlier, and this is interesting. I've read a lot of different books, nothing as much as some of you probably, or Vic, who really impresses me with his reading, but some Eastern philosophy, and I'm not saying it's right or wrong or that there is or isn't a higher whatever, but they teach you to be much more externally observant of what's going on and examine and be objective and not be defensive or subjective and just not make a judgment, but just say, well, what happened? What am I doing?
One of the reasons it works going directly is because you're a decision maker and you can respond with variations on what you're doing that no one else can provide.
And you can be self-effacing and humble.
And you can also be creative on the spot and say, well, what if we had done this? And what if we
had
done
that? Well, what would have happened?
Somebody else would never ask those questions because they don't know the parameters.
They don't feel empowered they don't have the right. Does that help you, whoever there was?
That's generally my experience. Again, okay. If you go into it with an honest, open mind, you'll get better answers than anyone else.
Move on. You have two, but I can only answer one. Well, Mac might want to stay and answer more, but I only want to answer one.
I will answer it because it's important. How can I transfer this entrepreneurial spirit to my junior partners? Model what Jay's doing here. Take the time and the energy and invest.
Do equivalent to this. That's right.
Take people out of the flow of business and make it. Educate them.
And
bring
ask them two
it.
Things. I don't. Well, who is the person that asked it? Raise your hand.
Bill Miller.
Ask them to go out to your clients and learn about what the client. I mean, remember those questions, those 10 questions we asked you on the first day that some people answered, some of them not all. Take permutations or derivatives or model those questions and ask them of your clients. Learn about what they got started and get that entrepreneurial spirit. Ask them what motivates them. Ask them what, or friends or colleagues of yours. Learn their values, how they see it, and get your junior partners or your associates to understand that. And then share with them what you're doing here and pay some money to get them, as Max says, out of the environment. Because it takes, part of the process here is taking you totally out of your normality. What do they call it? Tony Robbins calls it pattern interrupt. Just screwing up with your brain and having lunch at a different time and not having a training program be like a seminar and not being respectful about certain things that you guys, and not being lecture-like. And just do things where you basically give them the power to contribute and you respect and you listen and you benefit and you acknowledge. It's a very powerful point, Matt.
This is my Andy Collins, Everything Baseball. How do I raise capital to get started and go full-time with no money now?
Well, I'll give you a couple of ideas. If you've got a great idea, you go to somebody who...
A great idea has a dimensionalized, marketing-driven business plan that shows real operations. Yes.
Not
just a great idea.
And better yet, you've got...
It shows how you're going to do it, where you're going to do it.
And if you've got an empirical basis that you can extrapolate from, it's even better, don't you think, Matt? You've done a test.
And it shows that somebody else does it, compares.
Or you've done a little bit, but you just haven't done a high enough level.
And if you don't know how to do that, there's a wonderful computer program called BizPlan Builder, which is relatively simple.
My recommendation is you think, who is a natural to own all, part, most, some of this business?
And who benefits most?
Who's already got my market, but doesn't.
Is there a vendor? Is there a vendor who you are buying from who is much bigger than you and would be happy to have you as an outlet?
If you're successful, he or she would make 10 times as much on supplying you? Or is there a company that's already got your customers and you'd be a logical adjunct to them, but you would not supplant? You would only augment their sales and profits.
Once you have a good business plan, a real business plan, it is not difficult to raise money. Money is begging for good business plans.
But it's got to be really good on the basis of viability. And remember, I said earlier, my trick for people to raise money is don't try to get it all. Make it conditional on performance. Take it in stages.
And rather than, if you know someone who invests in things or might be a potential, don't approach them and say, I'm asking you for money. Say, I'd like to show you my business plan to get your opinion because I'm going to be raising money. Go oblique. Make it low threat.
That's right. And if they like it,
If they don't like it, they'll refer you. And you're not putting them on the spot, because most people say, I'm too busy.
And you say, I'd like your help. That's great. Great. Next.
Do you copyright your direct mail pieces or ads? How do you prevent people from stealing your good ideas? And this is from Denny. I'm sorry, I can't read it. Smith. Is it Smith?
Smythe. It's really Smythe, but you changed it for business reasons, didn't you?
It's okay.
Yeah.
How do you do that? How do you keep them from stealing your ideas? He sells it to them.
I sell them to them. I mean, most people, it's amazing.
Most people can't steal your ideas because they can't execute.
Yeah, but most people don't understand. They judge you externally and superficially. They don't understand the basics.
Right. They think it's a gimmick. They think that if you copy the externals, it'll work.
Most people don't have the emotional, empathic understanding of the feelings, the needs, and the hopes and desires of the market.
It's the principles that are powerful, not the immediate copy or ad. The principles work.
Really, people paid me $15,000 for me to teach it to them. About four people have done anything with it. So I mean, I'm not.
Frankly, we do. I copyright my direct mail pieces. I put a copyright on it somewhere. You have rights to it anyway, even if it isn't copyrighted.
I mean, legally,
have,
it goes.
If somebody
back.
Copies you, it is actionable.
Yeah, as long as you have documentation, it's
actionable in any event if somebody's really directly knocking you off.
But I wouldn't be that. I wouldn't worry about it because you know what they think people can't copy is your.
You can
mind.
Also go to them and say, "Gee, you like it so much, why don't you license it from me?" It's no problem.
Let me tell that Mr. X.
That's well, yeah,
you can tell it.
I can't go in. It's too complicated. Jay used to work for a guy a long time ago. He made a lot of money. Jay taught him everything.
Lots.
Jay and remained somewhat friends with him, even though they have very different temperaments, when Jay came out to California. And Jay literally brought billions of dollars into this man's company.
A lot of money.
But when Jay left, of course, he was angry. Mr. X was angry.
He wasn't happy.
And over the years, he nursed this, and he said, I don't know why Jay went off and did business with my competitors. And one day he woke up and said, "Well, I know all Jay's principles. And he's a very good editor, and he pulled them all into a guide." And Jay and some other powerful people in Jay's niche, and decided to market it. In fact, I had
at a steep discount.
At a steep discount to get him back. When Jay went over and did business with those other guys, he said, "I really hated it. I'm going to get him back." And so I wrote a piece.
Now, parenthetically, I got to tell you a point. He was in a certain commodity-type business. I wanted him to go up and low. I wanted him to go lower, discount, and higher, boutique. He refused. He said, that won't work. I begged him for 5 years, and finally I said, okay. And so I went to somebody and did it, and we made $25 million. And he was mad. So after I begged him for 5 years, and he was steadfast, it won't work for my business, I said, okay, fine. But I was only being paid on a contingency basis, where every dollar I made was only because I added $4 to, or $3 or $4 to him. But go ahead.
So he's telling me about this. Mr. X is telling me about this piece of copy he's written, and I said, that's great copy. He said, it's really true. He really did walk away. But Jay finally, so he did publish it. And
he tried to publish it.
He went to the people in the business
affinity
list, and they all said, gee, it was sort of like here's this guy, and I'm getting him back. And it was so powerful.
It was sort of powerful.
Well, it was powerful enough. They were scared of litigation from Jay if they read it. List. And so they went to Jay and said, is this okay? And so Mr. X had to get permission from Jay to mail the list. So Jay's got a piece of the action.
I read it and I thought, this is pretty, you know, I didn't get mad. I thought it was pretty enterprising. He did a pretty nice job, but it wasn't perfect. So I called him and said, you know, I should be offended. However, you did a pretty inventive job and I could improve on your copy, but you can't mail anyone because they won't allow it unless I approve it. I won't approve it unless, A, I get half the profit, a joint tenancy of the names, and get the chance to make your copy better. And what's he going to do? See, the great attitude in life, the greatest revenge isn't to bury your competitor, it's to profit from them or from your enemy. And most people have the wrong attitude. It's not a negative attitude. It's a very positive. It's a constructive attitude. And when you do that, your stomach isn't eaten away. You aren't consumed with vindictive, retributional negativity. You engage your creative forces and juices and your resourcefulness and your agility in a positive, constructive manner. And construction is the key, not destruction. Does that help you, Denny? Go ahead. Anything else?
Just to add on the question of getting stealing, we all steal concepts.
Yeah, I don't have original ideas. I'm a synthesizer, but I'm impacted by some great thinkers much brighter than I that lived long before I was around. I've met and been influenced by a lot of people directly, live and vicarious. So the trick is to try to add value to whatever you do. I took things that influenced me from a man named Claude Hopkins and a man named Albert Lasker and a man named Dan Rosenthal and David Ogilvy and Rosser Reeves and people who are much brighter and wealthier and have achieved perhaps a lot more than I. But I hope
most
I added
value. Most of whom are gone now, though.
But I hope I added value and maybe innovated and synthesized and presented them in a slightly different way. I think if you plagiarize, that's disgusting. If you emulate and innovate, I think that's admirable. Don't you, Matt? So it's a very fine line.
Right,
it's an ethical
perpetuate
line.
They perpetuate their work.
A lot of people, unfortunately, today only want to talk about nouveau thought, and a lot of the greatest and most enduring and immutable principle-based thinkers, their stuff is more powerful today, but there's no one really continuing it, no one that's basically bringing it forward. So sometimes you can do a noble job if you go back in time. Knocking people off is a very delicate thing. Philosophically, if you add value, concepts are almost impossible to, I think, protect. But I think you owe it to yourself and to anyone you're trying to offer a product or service to, if you're going to try to utilize or benefit from a concept, try to do so by adding value and innovating it. And I think you do a noble service to the customer.
How can you license an idea or even a product like, for instance, this is from Sally Moorhead, like a special kind of target? My competitors just copy what works and skip my flops. How do they know what are your flops and what are your successes? You could do a great disinformation thing where you promote something that's really a business killer.
That's right.
And have them think that's what you do. Todd Taskey, what is the most powerful risk reversal I can offer to distinguish myself from the crowd in financial planning?
Well, I think that there's a couple of them. I think the best one, where are you? Do you have a great track record? How long have you been doing it? How have you performed for people? How many people lost money or lost ground or didn't get the outcome that they... Well, I think the greatest risk reversal is saying, I won't take your money or take you as a client until and unless you get on the phone privately and call at least 20 people that I've worked with at least 3 years, 10 of which are looking for aggressive income, 10 of which are trying to preserve their assets, 10 of which are trying to restructure their finances for a combination or for high speculation. Ask them at least these 10 questions that are very probing, listen to their honest answers, and then talk to two people who left me who I had and asked them their opinion. And only then would I mean, that's the best thing I would do if they'll say good things. I mean, that's much more powerful than any guarantee. Just say, look, everything I say is subjective because I want your business. But I only want your business because I think I can grow it, protect it, husband it, expand it better. But that's my opinion. I don't think you should ever engage in anything anybody says unless you first talk to people that have dealt with him on different bases than people who've left him and two people who didn't go with him and get their well-balanced opinion and then make your own well-reasoned decision. That's very powerful, Todd.
What about a risk refund?
Well, you may not be able to do one because of the nature of...
Unless you mean you can do this. You can refund their fees if they don't hit... If you say this, I can't give you back your money if you lose it, but I can tell you this. If you don't need the money, you can say this. I make $3,000 on your account. I'll put that $3,000 in an interest-bearing account. I won't draw it out until 12 months and 1 day from today. If we haven't come up with a satisfactory performance, I will call you exactly 12 months, and if you want, you can have my part of the fee returned to you. That's relatively powerful, isn't it? Does that help? Okay.
Okay, here's a letter from Ruth Lewis, who wondered what she could do with her letter to solicit... to advise her clients that there's been major sea changes in the way independent contractors or classified major
firms. There's an article about it in Forbes, or I think I'd reread that.
Basically, all you have to do here is put enormous screaming warning regulatory alert at the top of this letter, and your letter's fine from then on in.
Okay, good.
And you can put it on the envelope or have it show through.
And I would make that letter recurring. I would just not do one. I just keep sending.
Send a notice.
And the key may be who you're sending it to also.
Yeah.
And you might send it to a lot of CPAs, a lot of business owners, whoever the right person is. I don't know who the right recipient is. What's the next question?
Next question is, what approach would you take to advertise a rental company? Let's guess who that is.
I wonder what kind of rental it is.
Do you think it might?
Like home rental? No. Let's see.
Special events, right?
Well, yeah, but you know what? I did a rental company. I did a big rental company somewhere in Michigan once. And where are you at geographically? Texas?
Tyler, Texas.
I did Michigan one. And basically, we did a lot of joint ventures. We also did...
Joe Girard referrals?
We did referrals, but we did joint ventures with other organizations that had the right... I mean, they did big, heavy equipment. Are you heavy or small?
Both.
You know, I mean... there's a lot of possibilities. First thing is find out whoever has already got. There's other people calling on those businesses. Who else is calling on them who's already got a relationship would love to represent you? You could triple your business overnight by making joint ventures with them. Number two, go to a radio station that's well-received and basically quantify your business levels on a trended basis by seasonality. Tell them, this is what I'm doing. It's what I did with John Holtz. Say, I'm averaging $50,000 a month or whatever you're doing. That's what I'm doing a month in different seasons. First $50,000 I'm going to do with or without advertising. If you want to run a minimum of a certain number of frequencies every week for me, I'll give you 10% of all the volume above that every month, and I'll give you a report every day. We'll work with you, and you'll be the only radio station I advertise on, and work joint ventures like that, because a lot of them will do that if you make a good presentation, and you'll get a lot more advertised. Like John gets... I think the deal we worked out with his associate who was here was they get like $40,000 a month for he pays, they're a big station, he pays like a guarantee of 10 or 8 or 12 against a percentage of the increase over his base, and they run for him some months like $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 worth. And the only problem is he's not been cooperative enough to try a lot of different... You got to try a lot of different propositions, because just running time isn't the answer.
But you might want to make yourself a personality on air and become a wild and crazy...
Yeah, well, you're going to do this. Well, guys, what's your first name?
Reed.
Yeah.
What is it?
Reed. You do your own ad.
Well, Reed's in the studio today with what in the world is that contraption?
Right.
You might have different ads and different interviews at different times, because...
The
walls start shaking, or there's shampoo everywhere. Or you can have a lot of fun, can't you?
And make yourself a character. People say, I might as well do business then.
Does that help?
No, you don't. You have your voice.
You have a very distinctive voice. I mean, all you got to do is be...
You don't need to sound like an announcer. That would be
good. You sound like a guy for Motel 6.
Tom Baudet is a writer. They hired him. I mean, those are some of the most sophisticated ads.
Does he have a good voice?
Yeah.
But maybe the radio station tells you that, but they want everything to sound alike and be basically rapidly stated and innocuous.
Unless you work with particularly a morning, there are four words that matter in radio: morning drive and evening drive.
That's all you want. Or whatever the equivalent is.
And you want to talk. You want to talk. You want to develop a relationship with talk type DJs, people who chatter, so that they become. They tease you on the air.
They do live calls to you. It's worth it to you to take an hour in the morning for a while and go in the studio and say, I'll work this out, but I've got to do my
remote. They could call them up and say, what's the craziest thing you rented this
morning? What are you renting today? What's renting hot? And you could say, even to the consumer. We got a deal on backhoes. Any women out there need a backhoe today?
You
could have fun, couldn't you?
May I make a suggestion?
Oh, come on, Reed. How about what's a little smaller? Well, you know, if you're... carpet's dirty, I could do it. I mean, you could have a lot of fun, couldn't you?
That would be...
But the idea is fun. Make it an experience and an event that people look forward to because it's entertaining. You know what Arnie said?
Vince wants to get on this.
Turn the tape over now for more of the program on Side 2.
I just want to say that our good friend from Birmingham, if you really want to use the voice, you know, you talk about Motel, he sounds like Davy Crockett. What was the guy?
He does, David.
What was his name?
Tess Parker.
Yes.
You're right.
He makes an excellent voice.
There you are.
And you play the Davy Crockett theme in the background, I guess.
Right.
Until they come and get you. $40 million in a starving crowd, and I have the product but need to reach the market. Pre-senior, teenager parents, and I can't read this word. Something, is it hate? School photos?
Yeah.
Just tell me what it is. Just tell me what it is.
Kids from the age of 12 to 16.
Yeah.
Photographs at school.
What about them? What are they?
Terrible. But they don't come in for a photograph in the studio. The kids, parents won't send them to grandparents because they're so bad.
Well, that's
interesting.
Why do you assume that? You say, how do I reach the market? Why do you assume that's a market?
Why would you want it? It's that different. Why don't you just ask yourself, are there better markets? Is a better question.
What, people want photographs on what are epiphanal events. They want where life changing. Go to them when they're coming out of nursery
Make
school.
A list.
When they're graduating from junior high school.
This reminds me of Mac. We talked about the National Enquirer. Everybody says, wow, I'm going to buy an ad in the National Enquirer, and all I got to do is get a half percent response, and
yeah.
I'm going to make $3 trillion. And almost none of the ads ever work.
That is not a market.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I'd ask yourself, where's the best niche that is? See, the question you have to ask yourself in all your business or marketing decisions, what's going to give me a higher probability of a win or a success than a failure? If you can't say that that does, why divert, when you're trying to be an optimal marketer, why divert the effort on that when there may be 12 other things that have got 10 times more promise or more hedgery for you? Does that help? It's a shift in thinking, but that's...
I mean, you might want to go to... Somebody has to have a need. For instance, the people applying to colleges need photos to apply to colleges half the time or something like that.
Yeah.
But this isn't a market. It's 40 million suspects, not 40 million prospects.
I mean, can you afford... If I give you a little life project that will cost you about $40... to $100 a week. Can you afford that for a while? Get the Yellow Pages directory of every big and small cities and look up a bunch of photographers and see innovative ads that look like they're doing stuff interesting and call them up and introduce yourself and say, you know, I'm here in whatever city. I'm not going to ever be a competitor to you. I admire. I was somewhere and they showed me a picture of your thing and I think it's so incredible. I'd like to be able to at least learn what you're doing and your strategy in the market, and I'll tell you anything I've done, and I've spent $30,000 on my stuff, maybe I do some things you can use for it. I'll give you my knowledge first if it helps you basically cut the ice. And that might be fun, you know, and record it if they'll let you. Say, I'd like to record, but I'll send you a copy of the tape, and first thing I'll send you a note saying I'll never compete in your market. And I just want to learn and just start a networking.
Why don't you work on something that really is a market, something like where people on school teams or it, like soccer teams, I'm just saying independent sports.
I think macro, no pun intended, idea about shifting to things that have a much higher probability.
Well, people want recognition.
A lot of people are more bent on accomplishing what they want to do than they are doing what's best for them. And I think it depends. I'm inherently an opportunist, aren't you, Matt?
You can't argue with a marketplace. The marketplace doesn't want your stuff. You're not going to make the marketplace want it. If it really doesn't want it, either sell them they do want or get
a way to break it. But why waste all your energy on that when there's something so much more lucrative and easy where the velocity is in your behalf?
Sure. We got one quick question here, I hope.
No, I have a suggestion. Tammy Sierra. I recently, well, not recently, 19 months ago had my first child, and I was contacted by a photographer. I'm sure you've thought of this to photograph children. But the unique thing here was that he came to my home and photographed the child, so I didn't have to take the baby anywhere. Plus, offered me a 5-year plan where he'd take the photographs 3 times a year. And yeah,
on
the spot.
Terrific idea.
I paid him.
That's a great idea.
He said if I signed up that day.
You do it consistently, though?
We're already taking your idea and ran with it.
Right. If I signed up that day, I'd get $50 off, and I paid him $200 on the spot for a 5-year plan.
Yeah, that's good. Okay, that's good. Next, Matt.
That's terrific. Thank you. That's an excellent suggestion. That sort of gives people ideas. A lot of people walk in and take one shot and don't try to throw a 5-year deal. Only about 1 out of 20 design engineers around the country know the benefits of incorporating our material into their design. What is the best way to educate them about the benefits to improve their mechanical devices? Alan
Vandal. Wait a minute. Who is it?
Alan Vandal.
Where are you? Alan? Where, is that you?
Yeah, right there.
So,
what do they do?
What's your graphite? Your graphite, U.S. graphite, is that you?
How many of them are there?
Well, let me tell you what. Let me tell you what Joe Stump did, because it might be fun for you. He, at my insistence, did a test. He sent a letter to 1,300 SNL presidents and senior management and title companies around the country, and invited them to participate on a high-level briefing on a specific subject for 90 minutes by telephone last week, and he got like 15% of them, including the heads of CalFed, some pretty big people on it, and he said it was the most stimulating thing he's ever done, and he made all these friendships, and he was able to make all these points and share with, and he also had nine of the top real estate agents in America on the call, sharing from their vantage point what they wanted and how they would give more, why they favor one lender and one title company over the other. So maybe you could make it, you can have a high level briefing by phone. We could tell you how to coordinate. It's not hard.
Yeah.
You can get five or six people who've used it and could attest to the performance or the construction of the design characteristics. Get a couple of your resident engineers or the person who came up with the patent. Does that help you? But I would do
information.
Do a series of
information either seminars, calls, information marketing.
Continuity, not from a life, like forever.
But
every month, there's a scheduled event or information thing.
I mean, since you don't know how many design engineers there are, I don't know how you know at 1 out of 20. I mean, excuse me, but is there a design?
Okay, let's say.
But is there a design engineering magazine?
Yeah, they'll do a joint venture with you. She's got a newsletter design engineer.
Have you done press releases on what you do to the design engineering magazine? Have you tried to get yourself written up?
Well, there's
a place.
The magazines, I belong to an engineering magazine, and I know at least half of the articles in there that are run on a regular basis, and some of them are like serialized.
Sure.
Are promotional for the company writing it.
That's almost all trade magazines.
But you've got to find not just the self-serving, but an incredible, externally valuable and appealing and result-beneficial series of information. But you can have just every month. Like we had, you know, Jim Butler. Jim Butler became the former. He reinvents himself about every 3 years.
With a new specialty?
His new specialty is hotels.
That's one of Jay's attorneys.
His new specialty is really neat. He found out that because of all the bankruptcies and all the reorganizations, all these financial concerns are taking back hotels like this. And everyone looks at them as real estate, but they're operating businesses. It's a whole different. He's learned all about it. And every month, his firm sponsors a high-level briefing at a major hotel here, and they have a mailing list of 1,100 heads of whatever the workout departments of all the banks are, and they invite them nationally. Very few show up. But he gets some transcripts. He basically has all these things he does with him, and he's got enormous following clients and follow up. It's just a simple process. He does it every month. Does that help?
Our problem is that we're on the applications we're on, nothing else works. That's primarily industrial, military. There's hundreds of commercial applications. And we've had some breakthroughs.
We cannot
perform a high-tech plastic like Vestel.
But can't you? I mean, what's the problem?
The
problem is they're not coming to Saginaw and asking us to get
out.
They're never going to come unless you basically create demand.
How would they know how to find you? Are you doing publicity? Are you putting your findings in fact reports
magazine?
And sending them to anybody? Are you doing anything
magazine?
In the community?
Yes.
Do you ever do anything in it?
No.
Why?
They're not going to come to you.
What, articles or press releases or ads? Or find everyone who's advertising in it who's not directly competitive and do a joint venture where they represent you. That's just one idea. Does that help?
You have to get out of the paradigm that they're going to come to you.
They aren't ever. They shouldn't.
They won't
deserve for them to come to you.
That's true.
But they will flock if you give them a reason. If you give them a self-serving reason, they will flock.
You are suffering from the better mousetrap fallacy. It is not.
You offer a standard of lettuce. I mean, I don't know if maybe it's too hard, but if you had a standard offer of let us do an analysis to show you how many ways we can produce it for less, better, more, higher performance characteristics, gives you. Everybody wants an advantage in their market, too. If you're selling an advantage that they can get for less money or no more money, they can outperform, out-engineer, do it faster, have it be solid, or get contracts, that probably would get people's attention if you had a report you.
Is anybody tonight willing to sit down with him and talk to him about this a little bit? Because I think it's right in front of his nose. Okay, this is from Hal Chapel. Is it Harrius Sensor? We are the company that invented our product in Germany. The U.S. market was never developed by our company. Other companies treat this product as a commodity. We sell $2 million a year in a $500 million market. What would your steps be for us to take a quantum leap in the U.S. market? Step out of the box.
Who's this steel mill?
Boucher.
Steel mill? Is that what you sell, the steel mills?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. These are, would you
this, this is the other division.
And what is the product, please?
We're the originators and the manufacturers of a small chip that's called a resistant temperature detector that is probably the most accurate temperature sensing device on the market today.
What's the application?
Just about anything, Jay. They're used if you have a self-cleaning oven in your home. If you look in the oven, you'll see assembly up in one of the corners that is used for either the cleaning temperature or the baking temperature.
Is it price and performance competitive?
First, let me say that in Europe, the product is number one use, with the thermocouples being second, the thermistors third. In this country, it's thermocouples first, thermistors, and then RTDs.
Why?
Because the American market up to this point wasn't as conscientious and educated for temperature as well as the Europeans and the other markets.
But they don't get this. Let me ask the question again. Is it price and performance competitive?
Yes, yes.
Maybe one of the answers is if people redesign products at certain intervals, if you guys had enough money, if you went to a lot of manufacturers and offered to fund redesigning when it came to, as long as you put the money up or you put part of the money up or you subsidized or collaborated, if they would redesign with your product, that might be an inducement.
The other thing is to triple or quadruple or quintuple the price of your product and go after niche applications where you do heavy engineering where it's critical. Because
I mean, we'll spend some time over the months on the phone together on it, okay?
See, because if the market's insensitive to the value, the engineering value in the sense that you're talking about, you have to find the segments that are sensitive. That means you don't go to the commodity level pricing, you go to niche level pricing. What if you sell books, pre-release prices to test marketability and receive too few orders to write it? Send a letter saying you're sorry, you can't fulfill. Here's a coupon.
And give back the check. It's great to
do. And here's
a check.
Here's a gift.
We get a couple things that just blew people's mind. I didn't do it intentionally, but it was powerful. When I sold one of my businesses to somebody, they tried to renew it. They got $400,000 in renewals, but I had a contract where they owed me $250,000 a year, and they didn't want to pay me, so they sent back 400,000 checks. And I wrote the people back afterwards and offered it to them again, and they couldn't believe it and would send them back real money. We did a program one time. We had all these proteges. It was very fascinating we did that, remember? Those proteges, and we did a reunion.
Yeah, that was great.
At the reunion, I said, I don't plan on making any money. I just want to basically cover my costs. And I couldn't know who would come, so we pegged it at like $295. It was a nominal amount just to cover the cost and bring some experts in the room to put. And we got more people. We got an extra 100 people than we planned, and we made money. Now, most people would be excited about making money, but I told everyone we didn't plan it. So we had an extra $20,000 or $30,000 profit. And like 2 months later, I sent everybody a pro-rata check, and they couldn't believe it. Do you remember that?
Yes.
We did. We sent out $25,000. That didn't mean I would like to have kept it, but I said to them, I'm going to give you your money back. I said it. Our goal was not to make any money. I didn't say give it back, but I said it wasn't. We made $25,000. I thought, well, doesn't have integrity, so we send everyone back a check for like 50 or 90 or whatever the pro rata was. Very powerful impact on people.
How do I find my USP, Ray Sawyer, Magna Grow? Very simple. Sit down with your best customers
and ask them.
Take a tape recorder. Buy them dinner
and ask them what questions.
Say, well, I'm gonna pick your mind and turn for dinner, but I'd like you to tell me why you do business with me.
And ask them different questions. What about our business is most valuable to you? What is the best benefit you or your people get out of it? Why did you switch? Who do you use? Anybody else? I mean, ask them all kinds of questions. Ask them what they get in those people, so you can greater develop delineation.
Best way to use healthcare risk reversal in healthcare practice from Dennis and Joe. It's carefully, because it's in a health aware practice, people don't want the healthcare to fail. So it's best to tell people all the measures you take to make sure that there will be
and how important they are, and how much continuous training, and how you worry about them, and how you know that it's hard in the practice when you're dealing with emergencies to always be punctual, but you
and the fact that you're going to interview them in front, and you're going to make sure that you're appropriate for them, and they're appropriate for you,
yeah.
and you're going to give a mechanism for them to.
If you ever have an appointment, you always make sure if you're running late, to be notified, so they don't sit in the waiting room.
And just a due diligence.
Give them other kind of guarantees, like of their being treated like a really valued friend and valued patient client. I think that's more important.
What is the best color to use in projecting a class image on stationary?
Mac's better at graphics and colors. What do you think, ivory?
Ivory stationary.
With what color?
With
brown?
Or white, or absolute rag bond white on Crane's Crest with dark blue. Look at the White House stationery. That's what that looks like. As if you get it's this navy blue engraving.
So sometimes also we had a very nice looking piece one time that was ivory with
brown ink.
It was green. It was a really lovely
green. Ivory. All other things considered, ivory paper, a cream colored paper. Has a bigger upscale image as long as it's not cheap paper.
Yes.
than white. White has to be excellent in paper.
Yeah. Anything else?
My name is Al Bruner from Kingston, New York. If I were a chartered, this is for everyone on the panel. If I were a chartered financial consultant and a registered investment advisor, I'd like to do business with people like yourselves. What would you recommend I do to get an appointment with people just like yourselves?
I think if you were introduced by someone that I liked and trusted and know and knew, that would be the first step. And if you approach it, then you're going to educate me and you're going to show me what you know about my profession and why your skills are unique to me, that would make it different, that you're not just a financial planner, you're somebody who really specializes in the type of things that I have a need for. And took more time and educated me instead of tried to sell me. Because I must get 3 or 4 calls a month from financial planners, and they all sound the same, and very few of them ever really talk to me as if I'm unique and different and they know what my needs are. Very few of them ever get called and said, I was with one of your fellow speakers in your industry, and I understand the needs of a speaker or the needs of a trainer or the needs of an entrepreneur or a CEO, and this is what I can do for you. So I would approach it from that angle. But the inner endorsement would be critical.
Don't ask for all my business. Show me something I don't know. Don't waste my time. Tell me something that my guy should have told me but didn't.
Okay, good.
I think also to invite yourself to be educated in the process. And it's important because I want to feel whoever I am, as important as I am. You have something coming to me that if you come to me, approach me from a point that you will be enriched also in terms of information, in terms of how you can be more flexible and grow whatever it is that you're doing as a result of that interaction with me, not simply as a result of the financial transaction. Because quite often people who are extremely busy, extremely connected, are successful also because they're providing service. And when you can key in on that service motivation, you can work that to your advantage as well.
Excellent.
Good. Mike, you want to say something?
Yeah, I'd want the endorsement again from a friend or somebody I trusted, because you're selling trust. And I'd add to what everyone else has said is the show me your track record.
Okay. All right.
Thanks. Fun?
Well, you're on now.
Thank you. Rico, I get love notes on my pager several times a day. My situation is that I've developed some very innovative executive consulting methods and organizational change methods, starting with my work at Hewlett-Packard and then after I left there. I do excellent work. I'm madly in love with my clients, and they love me. That's another reason for the pager, 24 hours a day. I'm successful, but I'm maxed out. And I want to stay small as a business, but I'd like to do better financially and make a broader contribution to the field. And right now I'm locked in with, say, two large long-term clients that, you know, that type of thing, and feels like I'm not making enough of a contribution and not leveraging enough.
The question is,
what ideas would you have for taking the resource that I am and expanding?
I'll give you flips. Number one is think through other services, probably more than products, that you could introduce to your... Find people who are the equivalent of you out there as far as capability, passion, but they don't have the success rate, and bring them through you and share equitably in the process of bringing them, if they're not competitive, to these same resources. That's one. Number two, codify and figure out what it is about what you do that can be either licensed or repackaged in a way that's automatic and it can be mechanized and it's on tape, video. That's one. Number two, what I did 1 year is we taught 1,000 people how to become what I'll call Junior J. Abraham. I realized that there was no way. At $3,000 an hour, a lot of people aren't going to pay me. At 25% of the profit, which is what I used to do, and 50% on new product profit centers I created, most small companies couldn't possibly, I couldn't even justify them. And there were, out of 19 million companies, you know, 18,900,000 were really not prospects for me. So I figured there'd be a lot of people who would love to take the same techniques to smaller businesses. We trained 1,000 people. Of the 1,000 people, approximately 50% were business owners. Who weren't really, they didn't want, just wanted to learn it from a different point of view, because I taught it differently. I taught how I do it when I was doing hands-on consulting.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
About the other 500, about 120 or so, actually, I mean, a lot of people don't do anything, but 120 probably did it. Of the 120, probably half of them did really well, and half of them probably never really actuated, but I probably touched a lot of people with 75 of them, and I also went... I took my techniques and taught it to people in Australia. So where do you have, we got to sort of figure where you have leverage. Does that help?
Yeah. Yes, it does.
Okay,
lot.
Good.
Thank you.
My name is Ralph Warren. I'm with Warren Companies. We distribute products in about 10 states in the Northern Plains through a dealer network. And one of the products that we have coming up is going to be an extremely high-demand product. And if we could... transfer some of the things that we've learned today about testing, advertising, and risk reversal, and some of the other concepts, our dealers could capitalize on this new product, and of course then we would benefit from
what they... Okay, so then your question is?
Yes.
What do we...
My question is, how do we transfer this information to them?
Let me tell you what you don't do. You don't try to shove it down their back in one day or down their throat. You do it methodically over a long period of time where you work with them. Are they all over the country?
They're all over 10 states, yeah.
Okay. Well, the nice thing you should know is you could go to them. How many are there? How many dealers?
It's about 400.
Okay. What does it cost? What's the profit potential if they really do this for you? A lot?
The profit potential for them is...
So for you first, for you. What's the profit potential for you?
$5 or $6 million.
Okay, over what period of time?
A year.
Okay. So you could probably afford putting together either road shows where you go to them and do mini versions of this in your own interpretive manner, codifying it as it applies directly to them, or, getting someone to create it for you and create like a vertical version. So I used to do vertical ones. I'd go to an industry and we create a certain vertical approach and we go to a certain industry and we just make everything modified right to them. So doing that for yourself to the industry Number two, if bringing people to you. Number three is doing it by video conferencing, which you can do in almost every major city. Number four is doing it by conference call, which I told you about. Number five is doing it by a sequence of audio or video tapes. You send them out weekly or daily, and basically hand-holding and hands-on. You got a better idea? That's what I would do. Good luck.
Henry Borenson, Allentown, Pennsylvania. I'd like to go back to the question I raised yesterday. Is it possible for a business to grow too quickly? And if so, how can one either prevent that or manage it?
You need, if you really see the potential for high growth, you either must, as the leader of your organization, you either have to train yourself to be a manager and get professional guidance, much as you have here for marketing, or you have to hire a professional manager. Those are your only two alternatives. Management is a science and an art at the same time, but self-taught management is as silly as self-taught marketing in this present frame. You can learn a lot going to someone like Mike Bash and using his resource network.
Got an answer for him, Mike?
To answer, yes, it is possible to grow too fast as long as your growth gets ahead of your ability to deliver a product and you begin turning customers off. Is that basically what your fear
There's
is?
Two products. Product one is a good staff, a good support staff, isn't it?
Right. But is that the fear, that you're going to get ahead of yourself and not be able to deliver what you committed to? That's basically
He's also involved with the development of his product, so he's the driving force behind the product development.
Yeah, then I concur with what Max said, and that is develop the structure so you can grow the thing as fast as it needs to grow. Now, I will say UPS, by design, back in 1960, said we will not grow more than 15% a year. They capped the growth, and they've grown 15% a year ever since.
Because
they couldn't. They knew they couldn't train management quickly enough and have enough managers on board to run the business and deliver their
product quality. I would only add the following. If what he sells can be replicated externally and he doesn't have the internal management, he would be wise to consider a joint alliance, a strategic alliance with somebody else who can get him distributed. Somebody else could get him 10 times the sales, and he had to split with them, but they had the infrastructure and the contacts and the distribution, and all he had to do is sit around and be creative and innovative and come up with new products and make four times as much money.
Sure.
Unless he's hung up on dominating and being possessive and got some parental sort of other hang-ups, he might consider that alternative too, wouldn't you say? Anyhow, I hope that helps.
But that last point, Jay, is not a toss-away. That is often a more viable course for many people that increases everybody's happiness if you license or syndicate or be bought out in any sense.
I agree. I mean, my strategy in a lot of my businesses is I look for people who are more motivated and happier building something and managing it than I am because I don't want to do it. That's not where I get the greatest joy. I like to be creative. I like to be innovative. I like to think about things and reflect and be an original thinker and do a lot of research. Depends on what you like to do and what you're the best at. Highest and best use. Time, ability, opportunity, assets. Joy. Highest and best use of your joy.
Just to add a little bit, I take a three-pronged approach in terms of team functioning. And that's based in the three basic principles, the three basic doshas that we talk about that are evident in all aspects of the universe. I want to balance that within myself, and I want to balance it within the management team. That is the creative, the managerial, and the intuitive long-termer. So that if what we find often is that a spark of inspiration that creates a product or a new ad campaign or whatever can be very exciting. And it can have a lot of potential, but at the same time, if a person or a company is too set in that mode, what may often happen is they outpace themselves. And yes, in that context, there can be too much growth, or there can be too much appearance of being scattered. So one is understanding that those aspects within ourselves. And if we find that we are particularly one of those categories, much more so than the other, then I invite people to always get within your management team representatives of each of those types we generally are fairly good at getting someone who's a process person whose job is to be analytical and detailed and make sure things get done. We have fairly creative people from time to time that we come across, but we often neglect the person who is more, maybe a bit more conservative, particularly in the startup phase. And that conservatism is still very valuable. So I think what happens is neglecting that is a sense that anything is possible, you can do anything, and you can do it all now.
Randy Van Rieken, I have the real estate school in Las Vegas. My problem is one that probably faces a lot of professionals. I know it's going to face Jennifer if it doesn't already, and Reggie already expressed a concern earlier. It's very much a personal service industry with me being the product and the emphasis on personal. It's tough to recreate this on tape, especially when there's a goal at the end of it for pre-licensing education for real estate.
Why is it tough to recreate it on tape?
It's not as effective live, just like what I'm getting.
You believe that, so it's not?
Well, based on what I'm seeing here, I'm getting much more out of this live than I did off the tapes as well. Not that it's impossible to recreate.
Most people look at life as being black or white. If you think it's gray, and the fact is maybe it isn't going to be perfect, but if you could impact 10 times more people on tape and get them started so they could come to you afterwards once they're successful or with a little success, you'd probably be doing them a greater service than not.
That's where I want to go with that is I have another instructor who works with me, but the market prefers me by a factor of 2 to 1. How do you photocopy yourself?
You videotape yourself?
Live. How do you get those people to work with you, to try to recreate what you do as well as you do, and do that with confidence and let go of it?
Have you made an attempt to transfer both your philosophy, your spirit, as well as your techniques?
Yes.
Let me ask you a different question. You have codified all the principles, all the methods, all the philosophies, all the strategies, all the mindset distinctions that you live by?
Formalized into a written form?
Yeah.
No.
Well, why don't you go do that? Then you'll be able to teach. You can't teach it if you don't know it.
And if it's a question of style, you have to find someone with the appropriate style.
Mac knows this about me. I got a great gift, which was it humbled me. Years ago, I got this vision for doing this protege training program, so I wrote this incredible piece, and it was this incredible picture, and I sent it out and thought I'd get 10 people, and I could wing it, and ended up with 1,000 people, and after I realized that, I had to sit down for 30 days and figure out what my philosophy was, what in the world my belief systems were, what in the world I had achieved all my success by, what in the world I really saw as being important to me and my business, and I sweat in bullets because I didn't know what I was going to talk about.
I've gotten to the point where I know what I'm going to talk about is the transference to others.
You didn't hear what I said. I'll say it one more time as a gift to you. Sit down and write it down to where anyone will know what it is. And then sit down and share it. They will still not get it 100%, but they'll probably get it about 100 times better than they are the way you're doing it. You want to?
I think the question of what people respond to in terms of style isn't just content. It is style, it is character, it is whatever elements go into charisma. And you have to...
Tell them how you see people. Your charisma is predicated on feelings, on visions, on connectivity. If you see people, this wonderful real estate agents are incredible. They are what drive the world. They're the last bastion of entrepreneurs. They're people in the second careers of their life. And if you see them, but you don't share to your instructors how you see them, how can they have the same passion?
Okay.
Does that help?
Point taken.
Okay.
Ira Feinberg, Dean of Clean. I would like to be the dean of sleeping right now.
You won't even when you go to bed, so why fight it?
I want to ask you my one question, and I have been sitting on this stuff all day very quickly. Three or four very fast ideas that I made money with that are connected to your program that I didn't have a chance to explain. Just give me that one chance, and I'll be very quick.
Okay, real quick.
The one is I did a lot of video in my car wash that educates every single customer that comes in to the total services that we offer.
Great.
So they see for an hour and 40 minutes. They're only there for a couple of minutes, but I keep running it, and it explains to every customer exactly what services we offer and what the prices are, and it tries to induce them to take that service to help them. I suggest that anybody who has a business, it's a wonderful thing. You have the video, and you can make it yourself. The other thing is a book that I was just recommended by Glenn Osborne, who got me into a book by Dr. Chavaldi. I don't know if you've heard about him, but he writes The Psychology of Something.
Chaldini, sure.
Robert Chaldini,
yeah, it's a great book. Did you read it?
Anyway, in that book, I got inspired because in my own sales background, I looked at the general salespeople that work generally in the country, and everybody sells, they always go for the smallest sale just to get the sale. And so I did the opposite thinking there, and I took what I designed, I'm calling it quantum sales. Now, I think anybody in this room can increase their sales dramatically. It's one of the other pillars that should be on that revenue thing. By thinking along the lines, when you make an offer to somebody, don't make your smallest offer. Don't make your medium offer. Offer them the top Rolls Royce that you have, but not for the idea of just grabbing more money, but because you offer them the very, very best, they're going to be more satisfied than taking the other one. Keep that thought in mind. And so the salespeople that I train them, when a customer comes in, offer them the best. And what happens is, in 30 or 40% of the time, the customer says, yeah, I'll take it right away. So the sales soar. The second part of it, according to Dr. Chavaldi, what is his name again?
Chavaldi.
Yeah. He said, and this is where you win also by offering something tremendous. You, by offering a high price for something, and the person finally in the end says, no, I don't think I can take that. Then you say, well, how about this middle one over here? And out of a sense of relief, psychologically, Dr. Blah-blah-blah says, that you take the second one and you get a sale from that. Okay?
Okay.
That's the letter. There's got one more.
No, okay, so we're going to run out of time.
Okay.
So that's good.
This is a good one. This is a real good one.
Okay. You got to hurry. Hurry.
I'll make it very quick.
You're pushing my button.
It's not important.
Okay.
Here's a way to create tremendous leads.
When did the inmates take over the asylum?
No. This is going to create tremendous leads for everybody, all right? Get an 800 number and put ads in all your trade publications. Call me, my name, Ira Feinberg, if you have a need to get great information on how to make money in the car wash industry or to save money before you buy or sell a car wash. This advice by phone is absolutely free. Now, whatever your service is, if you offer it over an 800 line, people will call in. They'll call in, and you give them your empathic relationship. You give them your advice, and you ask them for nothing in advance, or no money. What you do is you get their name, their address, their telephone number, all the statistics about them, and now you have the beginning of a lead. Thank you.
Ira, thank you. That's good. All right. Okay. Quick wrap. Okay. Uh-oh, should we all duck?
No, you don't have to duck. It would be remiss if I didn't express my appreciation for the help that you've given me. I came looking for a snowflake, and I feel like I'm in the blizzard of 88. I'm going to give you a softball batting practice pitch for the last question. I have a profit-sharing program, and it is the best-kept secret in Fresno, California. Many of my employees have more than five figures in the thing, and one of my key employees said to me the other day, well, I've only got X thousand in it. What is it? It's not so hot. How do you get the people to appreciate a profit-sharing program?
Give them charts on compounding.
Yes.
Show them what it'll be worth if they keep like helping you make profit by the time they retire. Project Flow. I was in Australia. One of the most successful, as Hume Publishing has a correspondent there, and they project out, you know, what a certain minimal amount of money will be worth at a certain age, and they show how you can accumulate $1 million with a nominal amount compounding. Show them what it can be like if they can help, and show them how it can be even more if they help you produce more profit, and show them things that will help produce more profit. Mike, what do you think?
I'm right with you. Les Schwab tires, you ever hear of them? They own.
I'm terribly sorry. Let me step back and say, I can't hear you.
Les Schwab tires, have you heard of them? They virtually own the tire market in northwestern United States, and he's got profit sharing, and he's got a combination of deferred and cash. And I've never heard, you know, when I asked for extraordinary service stories today, I gave a presentation in Oregon, and I had 8 people in the group, and all six of the 8 people had stories about Les Schwab. I went there, and people were literally jogging around the car with tires to get the customer out of there quickly. And I read his book, and he talks about profit sharing. Now, what he did is exactly what Jay and Mac were talking about. He projected for me in the book how much I could earn as a tire changer, and literally I could retire with $300,000 in this program as a tire changer if I never did anything else but tire change.
How you could be earning $30,000 a year and
$30,000 a year in retirement, exactly. Just by being a tire changer, but being a great tire changer.
And he just went on and on about that and depicted the program, but projected out for them what it meant to them at retirement if they never did anything else but change tires.
You see, the restaurant people don't usually stay around for retirement. This is usually an entry-level job, although we do have
But the point is this, that you take them at a point in their life. It doesn't matter.
Exactly.
You say, how would you like when you leave here for your next career to have enough money to put down on a new house, to have enough money to buy a small condo, to have enough money to buy a brand new BMW? Because that's what you could create for yourself in addition to your salary. Just by, you give them a reference frame they can relate to that's realistic at the point in time that they leave you. Does that help?
It does, and I thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot. You made a nice contribution.
We hope you've enjoyed this edition of The Wizard's Edge, and you'll have the opportunity to listen to the tape several times to get full benefit from the insight shared by Jay, his associates, and friends. In the meantime, we look forward to sharing more insights on the next edition of The Wizard's Edge with marketing genius Jay Abraham. This is Marty Stacey saying goodbye for now.